Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin took a stroll on the moon on July 20th, 1969. That and many events and stories of the moon, some real, some fiction, are brought together in a book called The Moon, subtitled A History for the Future, which is by the British author Oliver Morton, science writer and editor. He's written about outer space now for decades in three prior books and a pile of articles published in journals ranging from The Economist to The New Yorker. And there is an asteroid named after Oliver Morton. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Very nice to be here.
So the second paragraph of the book reminds us how many countries have sent probes to the moon. So it sounds like we still think we have a lot to learn about it and from it.
Well, yeah, there's certainly a lot more to learn about the moon, but also, as you mentioned, you know, everyone likes the moon, and it's the thing in space that if you want to go to, it's the nearest and most convenient. So it's sort of like the obvious first date for a space program, right? So once you've done orbiting the Earth, that's the very beginning. The next thing that it's obvious to do is to go to the moon, and so that's what. And so, and these days, you don't have to be a particularly big or ambitious sort of space program to do that. So, yeah, there are a lot of people headed that way. Certainly, a lot of robots, and probably some real human people too.
So, Oliver, would you say the interest is about interest in the moon itself, or is a lot of this about what the moon can do for us in terms of things we could potentially mine there, or using it as a stepping stone to the places like Mars and other worlds?
You're kind of right. The interest in the moon itself, though, you know, it's a scientifically interesting object and also has its own sort of like stark, sublime beauty. The interest in the moon itself is relatively scant once you move beyond the sort of like world of lunar geology. The thing that the moon most obviously gets you is status. I mean, it was obviously, although I don't think that, I think it would be cynical to suggest that the Apollo program was entirely about America showing its technical supremacy to the world. I know a lot of people very sincerely believed that Apollo was, you know, a moment of all human destiny rather than a moment of great American achievement. But it was also great American achievement, and that's what paid the bills for it, really. And now that people are talking about going back, again, one of the things that you get from the moon is showing that you're the sort of nation that can go to the moon. And certainly if you're thinking about putting people there, that's still a relatively small club. There aren't that many nations and power blocks on Earth that could send people to the moon. And so that's why, for instance, your vice president has told NASA that it needs to get back to the moon before the Chinese get there. The Chinese want to get there. They're not in a terrible rush, but they'd probably like to be there before the Indians get there. The Europeans are not at the moment talking about their own missions to put humans on the moon, but you can be fairly sure that if other people start going, they'll tag along too, and so it goes. So the first thing you get going to the moon is prestige, and that may be most of what you get. But there are people who want to sort of like exploit its resources too.
That's a lot to pay for prestige, though, isn't it? I mean, you pointed out how much money the American agency spent in putting our people on the moon. It ended up being a fairly significant chunk of the federal budget.
It is a great deal cheaper now. I mean, it's not nothing, but at the moment, the NASA is talking in the sort of like low tens of billions, whereas in the 1960s, the Apollo program brought into today is in the hundreds of billions. And just for comparison, the International Space Station program has cost something like $100 billion to date. It's rather hard to tell the exact numbers. So it's not nothing, but it's not any longer sort of like the thing that only a superpower that really wants to do it can do.
In the book, you manage to balance the romance and the wonder that we have for the moon on one hand with the science on the other, but I'm struck early in the book by astronomers and their feelings about the moon. It seems that they have almost no use for it. Why?
Astronomers really don't, by and large, much care for the moon in their professional lives. They may think it just as beautiful as all the rest of us in their private lives. And lots of amateur astronomers love to look at the moon because it is a fascinating, you know, with a fairly small telescope, you can get a lot of fun out of looking at the moon and watching as different peaks and different planes come into view as the edge of the moon very, as the edge of the day on the moon moves very, very slowly across its surface. It's a fascinating thing to do. But yeah, the professionals, they mostly like to look at distant galaxies. And for them, the moon is just a way of putting sort of like bright light, a smeared bright background into their sky. And they resent it, frankly. And serious astronomers, the sort of people who sort of like make up university astronomy departments, they don't much care for the moon.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, you know, it's one of these things. You know, at one point the moon was, you know, the only thing that you could really look at in the sky, and then the telescope starts to make it possible to look at other planets, and then the telescope starts to make it possible to really study other stars, and spectroscopes make it possible to learn what those other stars are made of. And the universe becomes sort of like much richer and fuller. And if it wasn't for the fact that the moonlight actually gets inside their telescopes and messes up their observations, I'm sure professional astronomers would just say, hey, it's great, it's all right, the starter slopes of exploring the cosmos. But because it does actually mess up their observations, they tend to be a little more sniffy about it. However, geologists, they like the moon because, you know, it's a source of rocks, and geologists like rocks. So
they do indeed.
What it loses with the telescope crowd, it gains with the hammer crowd.
All right, back with Oliver Morton and the moon in 1 minute here on the Jefferson Exchange. We're just talking about the fact that geologists love the moon and astronomers, not so much. But I had never heard in detail about Earthshine before you describe it in the book, Oliver. What is that?
Earthshine's wonderful because it's the thing that both physically and conceptually links the Earth to the most closely, I think, to the moon. So if you're out on a moonlit night, the moonlight is actually sunlight reflected from the moon. Now, if you imagine you're on the moon at night, so you're on one of the bits of the moon that looks dark at any given time, but which is facing the Earth, you won't see the sun, but you will see the Earth in the sky above you. And the Earth is actually much, much brighter in the sky above the moon than the moon is in the sky above the Earth, because the Earth is both whiter because of the clouds, so it reflects more light, and it's also bigger. And so at night on the moon, the Earth performs the role that the moon performs at night on the Earth. Now, the really interesting thing about this is that you can see, indeed with the naked eye, but also quite clearly with a telescope, if you're clever, you can see that the moon is Earth-lit. If the moon is a thin crescent, and you arrange things so that a wall or a chimney or something blocks out the crescent, you can very clearly see the rest of the disk of the moon. And what you're seeing is the moon as lit by the Earth. And that's, you know, when you know that, that's kind of a wonderful feeling, that the light is coming off the Earth up to the moon and coming back to your eyes. That's kind of cool. But at a crucial point in history, in the early 17th century, it was more than just cool. It was changing the shape of the universe, because the idea that the Earth was a planet rather than was a thing at the center of the universe was then a new and conceptually rather dangerous idea. And Earthlight comes into this story because if the Earth and the moon are the same sort of things, then they are lit in the same sort of way. And the idea that the Earth lights the moon in the same way the moon lights the Earth is a way of saying that the Earth and the moon are both rocky bodies orbiting the sun. And that Copernican idea is very scandalous to some in the early 17th century, but it's also, as it happens, correct, and it goes on to take over the popular imagination. And the way that an everyday person, rather than someone with a telescope, can convince themselves of that is by looking at the Earth-lit part of the moon. poetically, some people sometimes call it the old moon in the new moon's arms, because you see this, you just get this sense of the whole disk with the crescent wrapped around one side of it.
That's very poetic.
It was a sufficiently strange idea that when the great science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke wanted to write a sort of like fairly realistic novel about future life on the moon, one of the first such novels in the early 1950s, he just called it Earthlight because he thought the idea of a landscape lit by the Earth was arresting enough to grab the reader.
It is at that, and I must say it certainly brings to mind the next subject, which is the idea of the Earth rising over the moon. And this is some great detail you provide to a story we kind of know. Tell us about Apollo 8 and how that famous photograph came about.
Well, Apollo 8, the astronauts on Apollo 8 got lucky because Apollo 8 was meant to be a test in Earth orbit of the command module, that's the little conical bit of Apollo, and the lunar module, which is the spidery bit. But the lunar module, which was really hard to make, was late, and they just didn't have a lunar module ready when Apollo 8 was ready to go. And so they had the daring idea that they would send Apollo 8 all the way to the moon, and they would put it in orbit around the moon and then bring it back. So they were effectively testing a different part of the Apollo program from the one they'd meant to test. And so these guys go out around the moon. They go, and they are the first human eyes ever to see the far side of the moon, the side that the moon keeps away from us, because the moon's arranged so that one side always faces the Earth and one side always faces away. So they see the far side of the moon. They're the first people in space to be absolutely isolated from the Earth, because the moon stands between them and mission control, and they're out of radio contact. And so they start orbiting the moon. And most of the time, for the first three orbits, they spend all their time looking down at the surface of the moon. But then the fourth time round, they change the orientation of the spaceship a bit, and thus they see the Earth rising over the edge of the moon. And this isn't sort of like a programmed part of their observations, but as soon as they see it rising, they're just amazed, and you know, they just see its beauty, and they start reaching for the cameras. They've got various different cameras up there and snapping away like, you know, the tourist with the greatest tourist view of the century. And that picture of the Earth rising above the moon becomes an incredibly potent symbol, especially when it's turned on its side. Because when NASA release it, they release the picture with the moon standing like a wall on the right-hand side of the picture, and the Earth off to the left-hand side, just away from this wall.
It was a vertical, yeah.
But they do it with the edge of the moon vertical. But once the newspapers and magazines get it, they flip it so that it's the moon rising above. It's the Earth rising above the horizon of the moon, and that really brings home extraordinary difference between these two planetary bodies, because the moon, you can just intuit by looking at it. It's very old, very dense, and utterly unchanging. And the Earth, just the complexity of what you see on that rising Earth, you see these whirls of cloud going different directions in the different hemispheres. You see very, very bright whites where the cloud and the Antarctic ice cap are reflecting. And you also see dark blues from parts of the ocean, and then you see the parts of the ocean which the sun is reflecting off, which is sort of like lightly burnished, like bronze, and you see a bright bit of land, which is the Sahara Desert, and you see darker land, which is the Namib Desert, and you just get this sense of something that's rich and complicated and changing. You can just feel that nothing can be that detailed and not be sort of like making up new details as it goes along, and so that picture shows us for the first time what an extraordinarily different sort of planet we live on. And you know, that's been one of the great messages of the space age, is that the Earth is different because it's got life on it, and that matters.
Oliver Morton is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is called The Moon, A History for the Future. The differences are underscored in the book right at this point about the figures on how the moon and the earth take in the sun's energy were just astonishing to me.
Yeah, I mean, the moon actually absorbs slightly more sunlight from sunlight than the earth does, because the moon is actually, although it looks very brilliant in our sky, the moon is actually roughly the color of an asphalt parking lot. You know, it's a pretty dark thing. It looks bright in the sky because you're staring at it against a very dark background, and you're seeing, you know, sort of like half a continent's worth of light all at once. But the moon, all that the sunlight does on the moon is warm up the surface down to about 3 feet deep. And then at nighttime, when the sun goes away, the surface cools down. And that's really it. Because the moon's got no way of moving energy away from where it falls. There's no way to move energy away from the spot that the sunlight hits. So the whole surface warms up together and cools down together. Now, the Earth, because it's wrapped in not just an atmosphere, but also an ocean, is very able to move energy around. It's able to move energy up and down in the atmosphere by warming the air and by evaporating water into it. And it's able to move energy from the equator up towards the poles, or down towards the poles, depending how you're looking at the Earth, I guess. And that provides huge ocean currents. It provides, in season, it provides the extraordinary heat engines of hurricanes and cyclones and typhoons. It provides all of what we call weather and wind. All this stuff is being driven by the sun's energy because the Earth has basically mobile bits, whereas the moon doesn't have any mobile bits. There's no way for the sunlight to move the dusty surface of the Earth, the dusty surface of the moon, other than a few very minor electrical effects. The sunlight that hits the Earth lifts up something like 16 million tons of water vapor from the surface of the Earth every second. The sunlight that hits the Earth is depositing more energy in the atmosphere in an hour than far more energy than you would see deposited by a nuclear war. The Earth is just humming with solar energy, driving everything. I'm looking out of my windows at the leaves on a tree overlooking the Thames, and the wind is blowing those leaves, and at the same time, those leaves are also using the sunlight in order to create new chemistry to grow more plants and to feed the magpie, which is sitting in that tree, and, you know, it goes on. The Earth is full of this use of energy, and on the moon, the energy is basically useless. It just goes, it sinks in, and it comes back out again.
It's kind of like Las Vegas. What happens on the moon stays on the moon.
Yes. It's a desert. And really, the most interesting reasons to go there are the things that humans do there. But I have actually thought about, you know, where would you put your lunar hotels?
Uh-huh. What do you think?
Well, there's the wall of a large crater called Plato. You've got a wall quite steep, but not terribly steep, that looks away from that crater down over Mare Imbrium, which is one of the biggest of these great big basalt plains. And there are a few mountains. I mean, the lunar mountains are not as exciting as people tend to paint them. They're sort of like fairly gentle. You know, there's nothing on the moon that, you know, knocks your socks off like Shasta does. But at the same time, you know, it's a view of the moon, and you would also, of course, see the Earth in the sky hanging up above you. And that would be a view worth something to people, I think. It's interesting, and Andy Weir, who wrote the book The Martian, that the very successful Ridley Scott film was based on, he's written a book about the moon, in which the main business of the moon is tourism. That people come up to the town on the moon called Artemis mainly just to be tourists. And the thing that they do is go and visit the Apollo 11 landing site, because it's probably the most interesting thing on the moon to most people. And so he imagines the whole thing really rather like a sort of like little and quite decorous bit of Las Vegas.
I was struck by the discussion of the astronauts that like the tourists, they were more interested in the human things on the moon because they could figure out size and scale based on those, but it was hard for them to figure out distances and depth perception on the moon.
That's right, yeah. I mean, depth perception is very difficult when you're looking at geological forms that you don't geological forms that you're not very familiar with. And also when the moon is a lot smaller than the Earth, and that means the horizon is a lot closer. And there's an awful lot of evolution that tells you how things compare to things on the horizon. That's one of the ways that, as creatures that evolved firstly on the plains of East Africa, we're pretty good at judging distances on flat plains with the horizon in the distance. And on the moon, all that inbuilt programming just leads you astray. So yes, when the Apollo astronauts were there, what they could judge the distance to was their own spacecraft. When they were out walking or out on the rover, they were pretty good at knowing that. And on Apollo 12, which landed quite near, remarkably near, I mean deliberately went in and landed remarkably near to a robot probe that had gone before, Surveyor 2, they were able to judge the distance to Surveyor very accurately because they knew how big it was. But when you're just looking out at this landscape that's been shaped by processes very unlike any that shape landscapes on the Earth, your eyes won't tell you, and your visual cortex won't do the maths properly, and you'll be a bit messed around.
Well, let's talk, Oliver, about the shaping of that landscape, because is the giant impact theory the most plausible now for the birth of the moon?
Yes, I think it is. It's not the giant impact theory tells us that it was basically invoked as a way to explain why the rocks of the moon look in geochemical terms very like the rocks of the Earth's rocky mantle. They're very similar in the different chemical isotopes you find within them. And this was a bit perplexing because there's no real mechanism for the moon to sort of like split off the Earth, but also if the moon was captured by the Earth having been made elsewhere, why would it be made of the same stuff? And in the 70s and 80s, the idea gained ground that what had happened was that a planet which would about the size of Venus, which is to say about 80-90% the size of the Earth, was hit by a planet about the size of Mars and in the late stages of the formation of the solar system. And out of this colossal collision, you got the Earth, as it now is, which contained most or all of the cores of both those earlier planets, and flung up into space with a whole lot of mixed up Earth and other planet rock that slowly coalesced to form the moon. And there are difficulties with this theory because it's kind of hard to see how you get enough energy to mix up the rocks quite as well as they seem to be mixed, while at the same time making sure that everything stays in orbit around itself, if you see what I mean. But it's basically the best game in town at the moment. And so somehow or other, people are pretty sure that the giant impact would explain why the moon looks like the mantle of the Earth, but without much, if any, of a core, and also without very much, with very, very little water, because obviously the bits of the Earth that got thrown up into space as molten rock didn't take much water with them, because water and molten rock don't mix well.
We are talking with Oliver Morton about the moon. It is the 50th anniversary, of course, of the moon landing. We'll be celebrating that next week. A lot of observations and TV shows and documentaries all happening at the same time. Oliver's contribution is called The Moon, A History for the Future. We will talk some more about the book, and if you'd like to join us, we can take phone calls and emails from you as well. When we return from this coming break, the phone number is 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Oliver Morton, the moon, and you in a minute 30. Oliver, we were just talking about the giant impact theory or the big splash theory, or it goes by a couple of other names as well, which brings up a portion of your book where you talk about David Brownlee and Peter Ward. They make the case that that how the moon formed might have been unusual, but had a very big effect on the Earth as well. What are they talking about here?
Well, it's quite a complex story, but the idea that Peter and Dave put across is that the Earth is special. Their book is called Rare Earth, and it argues the point, which was at the time this book came out in 2000, quite controversial, that although life in the universe might be quite common, planets containing complex life for a long time, as the Earth has, might be really very rare. And some of their arguments depend on the fact that the moon provides services to the Earth which make it a better place for life, and also that the moon, because it was brought about by this big cosmic traffic accident that we were just talking about in the last segment, is an unlikely thing. And although I think that their idea that complex life in the universe is rare is an interesting and challenging one, I actually don't think their arguments based on the moon are all that persuasive, because although it's true that the moon keeps the Earth's orbit, the way that the Earth sits in its orbit, the Earth's obliquity is called, quite stable, so that the Earth's poles don't wander around the sky as the poles of Mars do. It's not clear that without the moon, the Earth would be as unstable as Mars is for various reasons. And the other thing is that another point that they make, and which people have been making for a long time, is that tides are very important for life on Earth. And it's only true that life on Earth has evolved to make use of tides in various different ways. But whether life on Earth would be that different without tides is a little hard to say. I mean, obviously it's kind of impossible to say because we just don't have the example. It's certainly true, I think, that it was easier for animal life to move out of the sea and onto the continents because there were tides. Because, you know, if you imagine the sea just always staying where it is, it's quite hard to see how a fish might find occasionally spending some time on a mudflat a useful thing, because there'd be no sort of like periodic, there'd be no periodic moving of the shoreline in and out. So at that particular point in history, I think it may be the case that that lunar tides were quite important. But in general, I'm not yet convinced that the moon was a particular bonus for life on Earth. But the only real way to find out is to do lots of rather challenging astronomy and find other planets with life on them and look at whether they've got moons or not. That's the sort of like, over a century or so, that's the way to answer that sort of question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, a lot more in telescope technology that needs to come ahead of that.
That's the sort of thing that you can only do if you can build big telescopes in orbit, I think. And that's something that's certainly an achievable technology, but it's not one that people have yet mastered.
A phone call here from Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Oliver Morton, the author of The Moon.
Thank you, Jeffrey and Dr. Morton.
Hi, Grumpy.
With the upcoming full moon coming at us, I'd like to talk a little bit about the philosophy. Imagine that you lived in the center of that full moon. Jeffrey,
right.
If you walked outside your door, you would look directly above your head, and you have two choices. That big hanging orb above you is either comforting, because it's always there, or distressing. It's always there. And I invite you to consider your view from the center of the moon. It's going to, the Earth will be unchanging, but the position of the entire universe behind it would change. And I invite you to try and imagine the changing backdrop of the Earth as you're in the unchanging middle of the moon, looking up at that
That's a really good point. So, the place that we're talking about here is, if I remember correctly, called Sinus Medii, which is the place right in the middle of the near side of the Earth, of the moon. So, as John says, directly above you at all times. Actually, it would move a little bit in the sky because of some oddities of the way the moon's orbit works. But basically, there would always be the Earth right above you, and it would be considerably larger in your sky than the moon is in the Earth's sky. Though whether it would look so large, I'm not quite so sure, because the moon always looks largest to us when it's near the horizon, and if the Earth is always up above you on this particular spot in the middle of the near side of the moon, how big it would actually feel, I don't know. Again, it goes back to how we've evolved to think about things in the sky. But let's say it's a big thing, much bigger than the moon is in our sky. The difference is that on the Earth, you see the moon rise and set, and you see it change its phase. So sometimes it's a crescent, and sometimes it's gibbous, and sometimes it's full, and then it becomes a crescent again, and then it vanishes, and then it comes back. But you also always see the same features. The moon from the Earth is subtly different. It does have exactly the same phases. So it goes from crescent to half to gibbous to full, and then back down to crescent. But at the same time, it stays still in the sky, but the features on it change because you will be seeing the Earth move around. So John's question, having something big up above you in the sky might feel kind of oppressive, but having something endlessly changing rather than static like the moon might be quite stimulating. The other obvious thing is that if we're sitting on the moon with a human history, because like our ancestors came from the Earth to the moon, then we're obviously going to think about the Earth in terms of that history. And if our ancestors came to the moon because they hated the Earth and they wanted to escape it, then we might look up and see it as a nasty presence. And if we desperately wanted to go home, we might see it as a very welcoming presence. There's a nice book called Growing Up Weightless by, a now dead science fiction writer called John Ford, which has a wonderful riff at the beginning about a kid growing up on the moon just really hating the Earth sitting there in his sky, looking all important and smug. it's an idea that's been had, but I must admit, I've not really thought about the idea of having it. You know, you always see in artistic presentations the moon hanging, the Earth hanging quite low above the lunar horizon. Standing right there in the middle of the near side with it right above you, it might be quite a thing.
Sinus Medii, indeed. Thanks for the question, Grumpy John. You hit the jackpot with that one. Oliver, I love the description of the spacesuit construction and how those spacesuits really kept the astronauts completely separate from the moon until they got back inside the LEM and repressurized. What did they smell?
They smelled something somewhat metallic, a bit like gunpowder, a bit like wet hot metal, and what they were smelling was basically dust that had never seen free oxygen before, suddenly saying, wow, this is something, and so a lot of little chemical reactions there, and there was quite a lot of it, because moon dust is sticky stuff, and they tracked in quite a lot, and there's a wonderful picture of the crew of Apollo 12 after they get back, and they're basically filthy. They're covered in muck, and they're obviously so happy. It's one of my favorite of all the moon pictures. And of course, you know, once they're back inside, because the lunar module is a tiny spacecraft. I mean, its pressurized volume inside is roughly the size of a couple of phone booths. It's very, very small. So it's got no airlock. So to go out, you just pump out all the air from inside and open the door. And to come back in, you come back in and then pump out all the air back in. So the air, that's why the interior of this spacecraft gets so dirty, because all the dust that you can't bring back in on your spacesuit then gets sort of like vacuumed, gets sort of like sucked off the spacesuit and into the air, and then it gets into your lungs, and it gets into your into your mouth, and it gets into your nose. And so it's once they're back in the spacecraft that, in a way, the astronauts have their most intimate experience of the moon, because outside on the moon, they are kept away from that environment by these wonderful spacesuits put together by the wonderfully skilled craftswomen from the Playtex Bra Company, basically, right, who sewed and glued those spacesuits together for them. They're probably the best tailored garments anyone has ever made, because they were made to sort of like aerospace standards, with seams that were meant to be exact to 1/64th of an inch. Quite remarkable things, and not at all what people had expected. People had thought they would go to the moon in sort of like suits like what they called lobster suits, or like suits like suits of armor. And in the end, that just wasn't going to work. And so it was a mixture of modern fibers and rubber and all sorts of stuff that they put into layer after layer of these wonderfully complicated, all-encompassing suits.
There's a great section of the book, starts after page 100, where you provide some of the actual radio traffic back and forth between the Apollo missions and Mission Control. Mm-hmm. And there's just some well-edited, but some great comments in here. Apollo 12 in the Ocean of Storms, Pete Conrad and Alan Bean reporting back to Earth. And the lines are things like, whoopee, man, that may have been a small one for Neil, but that's a long one for me. I'm going to step off the pad, Mark. That's soft and queasy.
Exactly. I love the way that they sort of like go from sort of like this wonderful sublime to things like, oh, that aerial's a bit off angle and things like that. Actually, the line about that may have been a small step for Neil, it's widely rumored that that line was put in specifically for the benefit of an Italian journalist, Oriana Fallaci, who wrote a book about Apollo. And she told the astronauts that she thought that what they were going to say on the moon would be tightly scripted. And Pete said to her that, okay, no, I'll tell you what I will say when I get down on the moon, and that's what I'll say, and you'll hear me say it, and you'll know that I wasn't operating to a NASA script. So don't know if that's absolutely true, but that's certainly a story that's often told.
Do you, and you mentioned in the book that some people think that if we're going to refer to this Anthropocene period that a lot of people are referring to now, where the humans really rule history and the Earth, that it should start with Neil on the moon. Do you like that idea?
I like that idea. The idea of when the Anthropocene, this idea of a geological period that's defined by the human presence, the idea of where it should start is to some extent a little bit of a parlor game, though people get pretty het up about it, though, that's also true of games, at least in my family. But the idea that that Apollo 11 marks a change in the nature of human history, because it marks a time when humans can get outside the Earth and look back at it, that's quite an appealing notion for how history changes. And at the same time, there's a link going way back into the 19th century, but a very powerful link we can now feel in our own history, that the ability to go to another planet and the ability to change your own planet are somehow intimately connected. And I think that's a powerful insight. And marking the Anthropocene on the surface of the moon would be a way to pay homage to that point.
There is just so much in the book that we could barely scratch the surface here. So many interesting names and people and views through the centuries about the moon, but all captured nicely in the book called The Moon, A History for the Future. Oliver Morton wrote it and has been our guest today. Oliver, thank you very much.
Hey, it's been great talking to you, Jeffrey.